Someone just told me that there's supposed to be a snake has crawled under the pillow here. So I said, and just leave it there and we'll all keep our eyes on it and spread lots of loving kindness. May you be happy, may you be well, may you be at peace. May you find lots to eat elsewhere. Yeah, the power of goodwill and kindness can be very strong. Lived in the forests and the jungles of Thailand and also been in the Australian outback in the bush. And I've had many experiences with snakes and over my time, and even with king cobras. And generally, I found that if you just trust in your own purity, if you haven't created karma with them, and you don't have any ill will or ill intentions to them, then they won't harm you. Just leave them alone. And they're probably as afraid of you, or even more so. So we have a tradition in Buddhism that the Buddhist monks actually learn a chant. Maybe we should do it at this moment. It's actually a protection chant, actually against snakes. So I'll do it for you. Appamanno Buddho appamanno Dhammo app. Bhammano zango bhammano vanda nisire sabhani yahi vichiga sadabhani yon nana bizara bhomo siga gadame raka gadame parita pati gammanto bodhani so hang namo bhagavato namo za Dhanang Zamma Zambodhanang. So now you're all protected. I wasn't intending to talk about this, but it seems we're on this. The case of snakes. When I was newly ordained in Thailand, I went to stay in a cave monastery a long way away. In central Thailand, and it was a long way from a village on the top of a hill, a small rise. And I was sitting meditation in the afternoon in this small cave, and I heard a sound, and I opened my eyes, and there was a king cobra coming into the cave. And his head was about a foot away from my knee. And his head was, just keep very still if you see it. Just keep very still. And you can test out the chanting. This is your chance to see how good my chanting was. This snake was coming in, and I opened my eyes and I saw it there. It was 4 meters long, and about the size of my arm, and jet black. And so I thought to keep very still, that it wouldn't move and wouldn't get frightened as well. But then it started to come up onto my lap, and I decided that it was getting too close, so I went, hey! And the snake, the king cobra, just rose up and spread its hood, and we were literally this far away. And it started to flick its tongue out and hiss. Psst. And I can visualize its eyes right even now. It was very spectacular. Very sharp, clear black eyes. And beautiful white circles in the hood. And the rest was jet black. But I realized at that point, as it was hissing at me, that they can spit poison as well as bite. And they spit into your eyes, and then it blinds you because it goes straight into your bloodstream. And as soon as the thought arose that this could spit in my eyes, I somehow flew up without thinking, get up. I just automatically jumped up like a spring and landed on there was a bed, bamboo bed next to me. And I landed on that. And the snake got frightened and went down and then slithered out the entrance to the cave. But for some reason, it had got so agitated, it was angry, it was upset. It came back again and then rose right up. It came about a meter and a half because it was 4 meters long. And it was leaning right back to strike. They strike very high, king cobras. And it was leaning right back to strike. And I was completely surrounded by rock. I couldn't go anywhere. And what did I do? And it was amazing that at that point, I remembered this chant. So I put my hands up in Anjali and said, Appamano Buddho, Appamano Dhammo. A bit louder than this, actually. I was making sure it heard. It wasn't actually to much later on that I found out that snakes actually don't have ears. They don't. They can't hear. So I was saying it loud so I get the vibes, the vibrations. And as I started, and this chant is actually saying, by the power of the Buddha, power of the Dhamma, power of the Sangha, all that is wise, true, and enlightened, I do not wish you any harm. May you not harm me. And it actually is a protection chant that the Buddha gave, taught the monks who were living in the forest where there were snakes and reptiles, as this way of spreading loving kindness. I do not wish you any harm. May you not harm me. Happy, may you be well. And as I was chanting, literally the snake had come right up this close, and as I chanted, it stopped, and then it started to sway, and then started very slowly going down as I kept on chanting, and then went right onto the ground, and then it slithered, and there was a big crack in the rocks, and it slithered into that crack in the rocks between me and the exit. And so for another hour, I just sat on the bed and just spread loving kindness in the direction of the snake. May you be happy. May you be well. I didn't shut my eyes to do the loving kindness. And may you find lots of mice and things to eat. And then after about an hour, I left the cave. And I lived in that cave for another year, and lived and meditated in that cave for another year. I never saw the snake again. Every time I would come into the cave, I'd shine the torch around just to check to see if he'd come back. And so what that did was it gave me a lot of kind of trust in just the power of goodness. If we don't have or haven't created karma with these creatures, And we don't intend to hurt them, and they don't hurt us. Another monk I know was telling me that one time he was sitting meditation in an overhang, rock overhang, near the Mekong River, a Thai monk, and he said he just felt suddenly cool. And then he opened his eyes, and there was a king cobra wrapped around him. And it had its head just sitting on his shoulder. And he saw the head of this snake there, and it was his body was wrapped around him, very large, and so he just couldn't do anything, so he just shut his eyes and meditated for another 2 hours, probably thinking, may you go away. And then he opened his eyes and it had gone and disappeared. So you notice that animals are very sensitive to kindness and goodwill. Animals are sensitive to the presence of other beings, but also to your intentions as well. That's why dogs can pick up when you're frightened. Wild animals can pick up when you're fearful. they're sensitive to that. And so if you stay relaxed, stay calm, spread out thoughts of loving kindness, then it gives you a refuge, gives you freedom from fear. And even if you do get, say, struck or bitten by that snake, you've never done anything to hurt that being. And so you haven't created any karma. And then there can be a sense of ease. That's actually very important, this quality of trusting goodwill and kindness to all living beings. Very, very important. can sit all together in this room is because we have a sense of goodwill and kindness, a sense of mutual respect and mutual trust and mutual goodwill. So, we wish you happiness and wellness, well, to be well. And it has nothing to do with the talk I planned tonight, but I actually had a while back one of the members of the Buddha Society asked me to speak about ghosts. And I did promise to speak about ghosts. And so I've been postponing that for quite some time. And I was trying to wait for a night where it was raining and there was lightning and there was... it's been a long, dry summer. So, what I decided to do is talk about this in the context of psychic phenomena. We have all had, or many of us have had, experiences where, you know, we've thought of somebody, and then the phone has rang, and that very person has been on the end of the phone. Or we've been with somebody, and we've thought to say something, and then they have said that very thing to us. This is often experienced between partners or between parents and their children. We've had these sort of experiences or dreams which are very vivid and have come true. Some people have had these experiences, you know, the realm of the mind. And when we get into the realm of the mind, it's very vast, it's new ground. Some of it is so unfamiliar with us that it seems bizarre. And so I want to try and put some of these things into context within the framework of the Buddha's teachings. What's relevant, what's not relevant, how do we deal with our experiences? Because there are some people sitting in this room who have come up to me and said, you know, I have been sitting meditation and then suddenly I opened my eyes and I saw... other people sitting in the room is just skeletons. What's that? Or I've been sitting here and then I've just heard the sound of music. What's that? Or I've smelled a fragrance which is not actually in the room when I investigate. What's happening? Or I've been sitting in meditation and these brilliant colors, flashes of light have been arising. What's going on? And so I want to discuss some of these things and touch on various other aspects of the mind. And I've made a few notes because it is quite a large area and I wanted to try and cover as much of it as I can. So, you know, this area of what we call psychic phenomena, psychic power, what we're talking about is just the mind. The mind is separate from the body. But then there's also another area of, you know, psychic power, where the power of the mind is directed and put to use, put to work. How does that work? Or psychic phenomena. There's also the area of psychic purity, and that's specifically relevant to the Buddha's teachings that Buddhist teaching is talking about developing the mind towards psychic purity. But there are these other areas that are associated with the mind. And the areas of psychic power are not just found, obviously, in Buddhism, where, you know, people in the world have certain experiences which are strange, which are unusual, which cannot be explained just in a materialist sense of the word. Particularly in some cultures, they tend to have strong beliefs in this, or even a lot of experiments. For example, in the Soviet Union, they did a lot of experiments in the realm of psychic phenomena. They wanted to see whether there were such things as mind reading, premonitions, etc. And you know, the psychic is this mental ability, this mental mind, and then the psychic power is actually when that mind is focused and concentrated. Now, the mind can be focused and concentrated towards what is good or wholesome, and it can be concentrated towards the unwholesome, the negative. For example, if you notice how concentrated your mind can become when you're very angry. Become so concentrated on the object of anger, whatever that is, that sometimes you can't think of anything else. If it's another person or another individual, you can't get them out of your mind. You can't get the event out of your mind, or can't get the subject, the criticism, the negativity, out of your train of thought, because the mind is focused and concentrated. But it is concentrated in an unwholesome way towards ill will. It's unwholesome because it is not beneficial to oneself and not beneficial to the other and not beneficial to either. So this is why it is considered ethically wholesome, not beneficial. It takes one away from peace, takes one away from happiness, and has negative consequences to yourself and others. That's the basis of Buddhist ethics. And the way to develop the mind, to have these experiences, is when the mind is calm, when the mind is still, when the mind is focused. Now, most of our minds are not very focused. It's jumping. You know, we've just sat for meditation for half an hour, and I'm sure many of you have noticed how many thoughts, how many emotions, how many ideas and patterns of thinking arose and passed away in that half an hour. An analogy of that is the mind which is scattered. It's like I take this torch and turn the torch on, and then I want to see some object. Because the torch is not very bright and I'm not holding the torch on a particular object, then you can't see that object. But if the torch was very bright and I held it on one object for a long period of time, then you can see that object. And that's a bit like our minds. If our minds aren't charged up, if our minds aren't focused, if this torch is not focused, then we can't see the object. If our minds are not focused and it's not directed towards one object, it's constantly spinning and moving, then it's very hard to see something clearly. And so that's why to understand our minds, to understand reality, to understand truth, to understand phenomena, we actually have to charge our batteries, charge the mind up first, get some power in the mind. Secondly, we have to focus the mind. And thirdly, we have to hold that focus of attention very still on one object for a long period of time. Another analogy is just to look at the candle here. If I ask you to look at the candle, if you just look at superficially, you say, yes, okay, there's one candle. Just ask you to look at one candle. That one candle, there's a light. But if I ask you to look at it longer, and what do you see? Then you start to see the radiance. You start to see the brightness. Look at it longer. What do you see? You start to see the quivering of the flame, the flickering of the flame. You start to see the spluttering of the wax. You start to see the smoking of the wick. Look at it longer. Then you see the radiance around, not only the flame, but around that area, the brightness that it gives out. You may notice the heat waves around that flame. So the longer we look at an object, the longer we sustain our attention on it, the more detail we see, the more refined qualities we notice, their subtleness we can penetrate. And just like this, another simile is like this glass of water. If I hold it up and say, look into this glass of water, What do you see? And initially, yes, it's just a glass of water. But the longer we look in, then we start to see its clarity. We start to see its surface. We start to see the meniscus layer on the water. We start to see whether the water or the surface of the water is still or moving. We start to see the purity or non-purity of the water. Now, if we took then a microscope and looked into that water, then we'd see a whole lot more. We may see the dirt, or we may see the bugs, we may see the bacteria. We may even see, if we have a very high microscopic resolution, even the viruses in that water. If we had an atomic microscope, then we'd see the atoms of the water molecules expressed in that water. So what we're trying to see is actually, if we focus our attention longer and longer with more refined mechanisms, then we can see more profound levels of that water. And so too, the same is with the mind. Psychic phenomena arises out of usually a still mind, when the mind is composed. Now, there's many levels of stillness. The first level of stillness that a number of people, most people, experience psychic phenomena is in sleep. When you go into sleep, if you have had a very restful sleep and you've gone into a state of sleep with a peaceful state of mind, then you may have some visionary dream. That visionary dream may be very colorful, very, very bright, and then events can unfold in that direction. Or sometimes there's experience of floating or flying. That's a very superficial level of what's happening in the mind. Not one's not actually doing that, but that's the perception in that dream. What happens is, if one goes into a state of meditation where the mind focuses on one object, the first level of meditation is Kantaka Samadhi, where momentary focusing of attention on the object. And then there's another level called Upajara Samadhi, where it's a more sustained attention on the object. And it's in this Upajara Samadhi level that many psychic phenomena start to occur, that one will start to see lights in the meditation. One can even hear sound in meditation. One can have fragrant smells arise. One can have visionary experiences at that time. Now, what does one do with them? In Buddhist meditation, one should always remember that the goal of the Buddhist teachings, the very essence of the Buddhist teachings, is for the ending of all suffering, for the stilling of all phenomena, for the calming down, and then the abandoning of all what we call samsara, which is all conditioned, or sankharas, all conditioned phenomena, the abandoning, the stilling. So even though these things arise, a wise meditator does not take their attention out to those things. One knows it and then comes back to your object of meditation, which is the breath. Because it's like a person sitting outside, supposing it is full daylight, it is hot sun outside, and that person is in the heat of the sun. And that a person feels uncomfortable. So they think, I'll move to the shade of the tree. So they move to the shade of the tree and they feel a relief from the heat. There's a sense of pleasure there. Then they see this building over here and they think, oh, that looks nice. I'll go and sit down in this building where the fans are with these other people. And they come over and then sit down. They rest longer under a fan. But in this building, then they see, you know, different people, different objects, the Buddha image, the flowers, the candles, lots of different things while they're sitting down. If they were then to say, oh, this place, there's so much happening, I want an even quieter place, then they may go to a room and lay down. The monks will return back to their rooms, which are very simple. There's not much in them. And then rest, lay down there. and be very still. And this is an analogy of the abodes of the mind. The first level of the abode of the mind whenever it gets peaceful is like being out in the hot sun. It's not very pleasant, so you go under the shade of the tree in meditation. The first resting place, when you can keep your mind on that object of meditation, the first resting place is the shade of the stillness of the object. You're under the shadow of the object. Your mind and mindfulness is with your meditation object and not distracted, just for a short period of time. Then you decide you want to rest even more. But in that state of resting even more, which is the simile of coming into this room, this is the level of Upajara Samadhi. And in that state, you can have these visionary experiences of sight, sound, taste, smell, touch arising. But it won't happen for everybody. And please don't feel discouraged if it doesn't happen to you, and don't try to make it happen, because it's not the goal. Just as coming into this room because you're hot and tired is not to look around and check everyone out and look at the distractions and the objects in the room. It's to come and sit down, be very still and cool down and be very peaceful. The goal of the meditation is not to go out to these phenomena that arise. I mentioned when one of the meditation retreats I did as a layman over 25 years ago, I did a retreat at Wat Buddha Dhamma, and I was sitting meditation, and then suddenly I heard the fellow sitting next to me playing a guitar, or what seemed like a guitar, and he was strumming away, and I thought, why doesn't the meditation teacher, you know, stop him? He's playing a guitar while everyone's trying to sit meditation. And this went on for a long time until I couldn't stand it any longer. I opened my eyes and looked over, and he was sitting perfectly still, meditating. I never knew what that was. But that was just this experience of Upajara Samadhi. The mind projects perceptions. They can sometimes be memory, but sometimes they're not. Not just coming from memory, because that sound of that guitar playing was a sound that I actually hadn't heard before, the chords and the strumming. So these things can arise in meditation, and they do arise for people. But the object is, instead of coming out of your meditation to check out whether the other person's playing a guitar or not, hang on, focus back on the breath, fine tune. This is just something that's passing through. This is not the goal. This is not the object. I'm focusing to still the mind down, to purify the mind, to clarify the mind, and not be distracted by sights and sounds and tastes and touch. So this is actually the first level. So as with the mind goes deeper into meditation, then it will get to a point where the mind becomes one-pointed, there's rapture, there's happiness, and unification of the mind. And as the mind goes deeper, it goes to the highest levels of the jhanas, the fourth jhana, where there's just pure equanimity. When the mind has become that concentrated, that focused, it is like the torch, which has been completely, the batteries have been completely recharged, and then it has been put in focus. If that mind is directed at things, then it can see things very, very sharply. In contrast, there's someone's mind who is spinning all the time with thoughts and ideas and moods and emotions. Focus and points and can see very, very clearly, just like this torch enables us to see very, very clearly. And from that, then, if one intends to direct that mind to knowing certain things, then certain phenomena can arise. And there's the whole area of psychic phenomena arises. Now a lot of people may say, well, you know, if there is the ability to develop these psychic powers, you know, why haven't I had them or developed them or experienced them? And usually it's because of, firstly we haven't trained our mind. Secondly, we haven't trained that mind with consistency. And thirdly, we haven't then tried to apply that trained mind to develop these qualities. So usually that's arises ad hoc for most people, or not at all. So there actually is a way of training. The Buddha described that way of training for actually developing psychic experiences, psychic phenomena. Firstly, by going into what we call these jhanas, the absorptions of the mind on a wholesome object, making the mind solid, stable, pure, and pure. Then coming out and directing that to certain knowledges and certain directions. And so it's just like, you know, when we see, say, a great athlete, you know, wins an Olympic medal. The reason that they can run, you know, below, what is it, 10 seconds, 100 meters, is because of the intense amount of training they've done day in, day out, you know, both physically and psychologically, to aim to do that over a long period of time. And, you know, under certain conditions, they can run those incredible speeds. Now, you know, it's when we hear of those speeds, we can say, well, why can't I do it? Well, the reason is because we haven't done that intense training. We haven't applied ourselves in the same way, and we haven't then tried to the same degree. That's why we can't achieve that. But we can say that it is possible because we've seen others do it, even though maybe we don't have the ability. So too, with these psychic phenomena, there are people who have obtained and experienced these things. The Buddha was one of those people. But as I said, it is not just confined to Buddhism. There are these things arise out of the concentration of the mind. They don't necessarily arise out of wisdom. They just arise out of the ability to focus the mind. It doesn't necessarily show that one is an arahant or enlightened person because one has psychic phenomena. So maybe I'll say something about some psychic phenomena. Some psychic phenomena arise, for example, you know, we've seen the people who have the ability to bend spoons with their mind or have certain manifestations, you know, producing Rolex watches out of the air, act as mediums to kind of predict the future. Then, you know, the ability, even we hear in certain scriptures about the ability to walk on water. Now, this is sort of, you know, the general view of kind of almost the mystic or the magical abilities. Now, in Buddhism, these are considered completely insignificant. They're not important in the spiritual path. You know, whether you can manifest a Rolex watch out of the air, that doesn't really bring an end to suffering. It doesn't bring an end to greed, hatred, and delusion. It actually can just increase delusion, can't it? Everyone wants one. If Venerable Merino sitting here started producing Rolex watches, then I'm sure that everyone would line up and want one, and then, you know, we would be endlessly having to supply Rolex watches to everyone who arrives here. And you know, and then we'd probably get the Rolex watch company down on our backs for not keeping the copyright. And you know, it's not useful for the real understanding of what life is about. It doesn't bring an end to our problems of birth, old age, sickness, and death, does it? Many of us may have a Rolex watch on our wrist. Does that help you to understand ultimate truth? No. So these kind of superficial abilities or the magical abilities, whether they occur or not, for a Buddhist is not important. It was actually a very good illustrating story about this that happened at the time of the Buddha. The Buddha walked to a river, and there was a rishi sitting meditation on the side of the river, and he'd been there for 30 years. And the Buddha started up a conversation with him and said, you know, why are you living here? And he said, I'm developing the concentration of mind because I want to develop the ability to walk on water. And the Buddha asked, how long have you been doing this? And he said, I've been doing this for 30 years. And the Buddha said, well, you've been wasting your time because you could pay the ferryman 1 rupee and cross on the ferry further upstream. Because whether you can walk on water or not, you're still going to die. There's still old age, sickness, death, pain, grief, lamentation. There's getting what you want and not getting what you want. There's getting what you don't want and being separated from what you love. So this is what the Buddha was concerned about. He said, my teachings are like a handful of leaves. What's more, a handful of leaves are all the leaves in the forest. Of course, all the leaves in the forest are great. He said, so too, at the time of my enlightenment, the wisdom, the knowledge that arose in me was like all the leaves in the forest. But what I teach is just like this handful. It is for one purpose and one purpose only, for the ending of suffering, for the bringing to the end of greed, hatred, and delusion, the ending of all becoming, all dukkha. That's the very essence of the Buddha's teachings. In terms of magical abilities, that's not all that relevant, but it can actually happen. The purpose of the Buddha's goal is actually for psychic purity rather than psychic phenomena. We're trying to develop the purity of the mind from greed, hatred, and delusion. To purify, see, we know when we're angry, don't we? We can know that. And that can be abandoned. We know when a sense of self and ego is very strong. We know when we're overcome by desires for things. This we can know. And we can do something about that. So the Buddha's purpose and goal and aim is for psychic purity rather than psychic phenomena. And we can experience psychic purity temporarily in these deep states of samadhi, these deep states of jhana. And there's a very strong purification of mind in these experiences. Mind becomes malleable, soft, bright, luminous, serene, and concentrated. But that's temporarily. We have to come out of those states. But when we turn that brilliant mind towards understanding this body and the workings of the mind, then insight, knowledge, and vision can arise. And then there can be liberation from greed, hatred, and delusion. And then that is ultimate psychic purity, the purity of the enlightened ones. But now I actually will say something about these psychic phenomena that actually, from a Buddhist point of view, apart from the magical phenomena, there are actually certain knowledges that can arise from a calm and concentrated mind. And one of those is called the divine ear. Because to understand this, you have to understand a Buddhist cosmology a bit, in that this world is not the only realm of existence, the human realm. There are other levels, other realms of existence. There are the deva realms, the heavenly beings. There are heaven realms. There are lower realms, the realms of suffering, for example, the ghost realms. And when the mind is very, very refined, then it can tune in to these states. An example of this is one time a monk I know and another monk were staying together in northern Thailand in a place called Lumpun. They were living in separate huts. And at 1 o'clock at night, one of the monks woke up and he heard this very beautiful chanting. And he thought the other monk was playing a chanting tape. And it just kept on going on. And he looked at his clock and thought, it was 1 in the morning. Why has he got this chanting tape on so loud? This place was a long way from a village and any power. It was in a completely separate valley. And so that monk came over to see the other monk. And when he got to his hut, he realized the chanting wasn't coming out of the hut. It was actually coming from one of the hilltops there. And then he looked in the heart, and the monk who was there, who thought he was playing a chanting tape, was actually asleep. There was no tape, and he didn't have any chanting tape, or didn't even have a tape recorder. And this sound was very melodious, and it began as the sounds of male chanting, like a great number of people chanting, monks chanting, and then it changed into a sound like a large number of women chanting, nuns chanting. And this lasted for a long period of time. And that particular monk was not the only monk who heard that and experienced that in that place. And it was always heard from the same place. Now this person, had been in a resting state. Had been asleep and woken up and then heard that. Whether this is an example of the divine ear, I don't know. But it is the case where these other beings in other realms can be heard when the mind is focused and concentrated. It's like you're fine-tuning the radio. You know, normally if you have a radio, you've got to have the battery, a very well-charged battery. If you don't have a good charged battery, it doesn't matter, you know, how well you tune, line up the radio to the station, you won't get anything because there's no power there. So you have to have a powerful mind first. Then there has to be transmission. And also then you have to tune that mind onto the station. You're tuning the mind onto that radio channel. If someone's transmitting, then the mind can pick up things. The other quality is the divine eye. The divine eye is the ability to see these beings in other realms. And this is where I get to the ghost story. Okay, I've got lots of ghost stories, so I don't know how long you want to go, but this is an example. Whether it's an example of the divine eye, I don't know. I'm not claiming that, but it was a case of two monks that were living together in the north of Thailand, and this area was in a tea-growing plantation. And the villagers had built simple grass roof huts there, and their grass roof huts were about 100 meters apart. And one night, one of the monks was sitting meditation at 8 o'clock at night, and in his meditation, there appeared the decapitated head of an old lady. She had been cut off, her head had been cut off from the body at the throat. And there was she'd been sliced down the cheek. And this wasn't just a normal vision. The vision was so clear that you could actually see the muscles and the sinews and the layers on the skin and the flesh underneath. And the lady's hair, she was unusual for a northern Thai person. Most people in the north of Thailand tend to wear their hair in a bun, and they tend to have very long, straight hair. She had very curly hair. And it was, her hair was soaked in blood, and the blood was coagulated. And she came screaming in this monk's vision, in his meditation. And this monk said that he spread loving kindness to her, being aware of, you know, that's how one deals with these beings in realms of suffering. Wished her to share merit, any merit that he'd done, he shared that with her, and then she would fade away. And then she would come closer. She was about 65, but very, very angry. And she was screaming. And then after a long period of time, that monk opened his eyes and he could still see the same visual image of this woman screaming, almost trying to get rid of him away from there. This vision lasted. Then after that, because the loving kindness and the sharing of merit didn't seem to work. She didn't seem to be receptive. She just seemed to be caught in very strong anger and resentment. That he started doing chanting of the loving kindness sutta of the Buddha, discourse on loving kindness, and chanting of many of the other discourses. Then when he would do that chanting, she would fade, but then would come back with intensity. And this didn't last just temporarily, it lasted from eight at the night till 12 o'clock at night, so 4 hours. And eventually it faded. And then the monk said that he felt incredibly exhausted and drained. And so he laid down to rest. He rested very soundly. And then when he woke up in the morning, he said that his mind was asking, well, what was that? Now, was it real? If you have an experience like that, in Buddhism we say, what do you know? You know that there was an experience, but you don't know whether that experience was real. You know that something was seen, but was what was seen, you know, real or a figment of the mind, creation of the mind. And also you know that it's impermanent. It's changed. It's gone away. So you let go. So there's no concern about it. So that monk went down and spoke to one of the other monk who was living with and asked him, without telling him what happened, he said, how was your meditation last night? And he said, oh, it was wonderful. I had a really lovely sit. My meditation was really blissful. So I was in complete contrast. And then what happened was that a week later, the monk went down to the villages, and the villagers had actually asked them to stay for the rains retreat, but he'd been ordered by his teacher to go to another monastery for the rains retreat. And he was chatting to the villagers, and they said, well, we want you to stay, and we'd like to offer that piece of land there as a monastery so that you can have other monks come back and stay there. And just to be polite, really, because he knew he had to leave, he started talking about, maybe eventually that land could be offered as a monastery. And he asked, well, who owns the piece of land? Who's the title deeds in? If you're going to offer it, then you should get, you know, permission from them. And they said that it's one of our relatives. The title deeds are still in her name, and her name was Mare Som. And she was murdered 5 years ago. And the monk asked, well, you know, what happened? And they said that she was a moneylender in the village. And when all the villagers went out to to pick tea, she was attacked and robbed. And she was decapitated. And so that made the monk inquisitive. And he asked, well, what did she look like? And they said that she was very unusual because she had curly hair. And how old was she? She was 65. What were the signs of the wounds? She was sliced on her face and decapitated, and one of her fingers on her hand had been chopped off. But this monk had not seen the body. So is that an example? We don't know. But there's, you know, without any kind of collaboration, there seemed to be a cause, there seemed to be an association with what was seen in the meditation by that monk and then what was told by the villagers without any knowledge that that was the case. And there seemed to be, this person had been robbed and everything had been taken from her. And obviously she died with very intense attachment, intense fears, and intense suffering. And because of that intensity, the clinging, maybe the reason that she knew her relatives were going to give up her last piece of land, give that away, that was the reason she was clinging on and didn't want the monks there. Because her own relative said that she was a very angry woman, and she was very selfish, very, very stingy, and she liked to badmouth people all the time, very aggressive. And that was evidently what that monk experienced, was that, you know, that quality of the character, the personality came through in the experience. So we can We can sometimes, from our experiences, we can then find out that there actually are factual causes for that event, for that experience in the meditation, which then you can say, oh, well, yes, maybe that's true. Maybe that was so. Maybe there are realms of beings, realms of existence that are normally not seen, normally not experienced. There's another case, actually in a book I was given. This is actually recorded in the newspapers in Victoria. Interesting enough, it was in the town of Harrow. A harrowing experience in Victoria. There was it was 1948. It's quite a while back, but it was put into the newspapers because what had happened was that there was a wedding, and all the family had arrived. The bride had arrived, but the groom, who was driving himself to the wedding, hadn't turned up. And everyone was waiting very patiently, and he didn't show up. And people began to get very nervous, particularly the bride. And then about an hour later, he walked into the church, and he was covered in red dust, in bull dust, and he had his shirt was torn, and he had his handkerchief wrapped around his neck. And everyone rushed to him and said, what happened? He said, I rolled my car just about 8 kilometres from the church, and I've had to walk the rest of the way, and that's why I'm late. And so they, you know, said, well, shall we take you to the doctor's? And he said, no, everyone's been waiting. Let's get on with the service. And so they did the service. They did the marriage ceremony, kissed the bride. They signed the registrar. The minister, I was an Anglican minister, witnessed it. There was about 30 people at the service. And then they were going to go to the reception. And so he said, well, please go back to my car. I want to pick up some things from the car first, and then we'll go off to the reception. And so he got in the car with the bride, and then the rest of the families followed in a convoy behind. And it was sort of rolling countryside, and the car with the bride and the groom was in front. And the person who wrote the article in the papers was a relative who was in the car behind. Their car of the bride and the groom's went over the hill, and then the following car, when it came over the hill, had to brake very quickly because the car with the bride and the groom was parked in the middle of the road with the doors open. And they pulled up very quickly, and so did everyone else. And the bride was very distraught, and she was screaming, saying, he's disappeared. And the groom was not to be seen. And so they had some of the family stay with the bride, and then to calm her down, and then the rest of the family drove to where the accident had occurred, and the groom was dead in the front seat of the car, and the car was turned upside down in the side of a ditch. And that was witnessed by 30 people, and the register was actually signed with the groom's signature. And I'm assuming they hadn't been drinking too much before the wedding, but it was actually an interesting kind of story which had many witnesses. And so I ask, is she really married? And does she get the inheritance? So you can check out Harrow, Victoria. Check out that one. But the other thing that can arise is there's another case. As I said, I could go quite late on these stories of ghost stories, but there was another case of a monk I know who was sitting meditating in in Thailand, and then the people came to offer the meal. As they were actually offering the meal, he looked up and he actually saw a young novice, a Buddhist novice, float through the door and then disappear. And after he'd finished the meal, he asked the lay people, "Has a novice ever died in this area?" And they said, "Oh, yes. 5 years ago, one of the village novices, it was a northern Thai novice, 16 years old in the image, in the vision, had sort of bright yellow robes on of a village novice. And there was a waterfall right where in that place. And this novice had climbed up the face of the waterfall and slipped and fallen and been killed 5 years ago." So sometimes there is some correlation between real events and those experiences. Now, I'm not saying what they are. I'm just saying that some people have these experiences of what we call a divine eye. But these things, these experiences, do not indicate whether one's enlightened or not. One can have these experiences and be completely deluded, and delude others as well. The other experience in the psychic phenomena is the ability to know the minds of others. And I'm sure that, you know, many people here have had this experience where, as I said, you know, you're thinking of somebody and then the phone rings, or you're just about to say something and the other person says exactly what you're going to say. It's almost like you tune in. Why is that? It's because this mind is, if it's still and clean and pure, it becomes like a mirror. It reflects. A mirror reflects whatever comes in front of it. So, you know, if a person in a clown outfit comes in front of that mirror, then that's what is reflected. If a dog walks in front of the mirror, that's what's reflected. If a flower is placed in front of the mirror, that's what's reflected. And so too, the mind, when it becomes very still and very purified, will reflect that. And this ability of when the mind tunes in, it will pick up almost like the noise of other people's minds. Because your thought patterns is the noise, the internal noise of the mind, isn't it? And sometimes when you're very upset, for example, that internal noise gets very loud. Notice how loud it gets when you get very angry. The noise becomes a scream or a screech or a yell in frustration. It becomes a yell of abuse sometimes. It becomes very loud. And what happens the opposite? When you turn off that internal noise in meditation and the mind becomes very still and clear, then it becomes very open. And that stillness and clarity then can pick up other people's noise, especially if it has been very deeply calmed and become very focused and one-pointed in these deep states of meditation. And so there is this quality where people can know the minds of others. And having lived with many great meditation teachers in Thailand, I certainly felt that at times there was no other way I could explain how they could actually know and say the very words that I was thinking at that time. And there were certain experiences which maybe the one which I explain, I think I've mentioned before, was here that one time a friend of mine, a fellow monastic, received a letter from his mother saying his father was very sick and may die. Would he please come home? And usually as monks, we're not allowed to travel alone until we've got at least 5 years of training. We usually have to travel with a senior monk. And this would have meant that monk would have had to travel, obviously, all the way back from Thailand by himself. He was only newly ordained. And he wasn't sure whether Ajahn Chah would allow him to travel by himself to follow the request of his mother. And so he came to see me. He just opened the letter, and then he came straight around to see me. And he said, "This is what's happened. I'm a bit too intimidated to go and ask Ajahn Chah whether he allowed me to go or not." And I said, "Well, I'll go with you. You know, just ask him. You've got nothing to lose." And he said to me, "Well, don't tell anyone, and I won't say anything because I don't want this to get out, just in case you know my kind of wishes aren't fulfilled." And so I promised that. And then in the evening, we went around to see Ajahn Chah, and we were just sitting there. We had a drink of something with him, and fruit juice or something, and then suddenly Ajahn Chah turned to this monk and said, "Sotiro, just supposing your mother wrote and asked you to go back to Australia, do you think you can handle yourself properly?" And he immediately looked at me as if I'd let out the spilled the beans. And I immediately looked at him as if he'd spilled the beans. And then we both looked at Ajahn Chah, and he just, Sotiro said, "Yes, I think I could handle myself properly." And Ajahn Chah just said, "Well, you can go." We hadn't said anything. And we asked just about every monk in the monastery, and neither of us had mentioned it to each other. None of the other monks knew about it. But for some reason, why, whether that was a case of mind reading, I don't know, but it was very surprising that he seemed to speak about that, suggest that very thing we're about to ask, whether that was a case. Another case was one time I was with a monk in Thailand, and there was just the two of us sitting under his hut, and there was two men who looked fairly ragged, and three people looked fairly ragged and scruffy. They walked along a railway track, and they came into the monastery. And they came up, and they started to bow down. And the senior monk that I was with immediately looked at them, and then he looked at them very intensely. And just before their heads hit the floor to bow, he said, "Why did you kill that man?" Which is an unusual introduction, yes. So it took me back, and they just started shaking, and then they blurted out this confession that yes, they were just escaping from a scene of a crime. That they had they'd been hired by somebody to dig for rupees in that area. He hadn't paid them for months, and so they beat him to death. And they were escaping along the railway tracks. And this monk then said to them, "Go and have something to eat in the kitchen." And then he said, and when they left, he said to me, "In 5 minutes' time, the police are going to be coming in. Go straight back to your hut." And he just went up to his room and shut the door. And I went straight back to my hut and shut the door and looked out the window. And literally, in 5 minutes' time, a police car came into the monastery. The only time I'd ever seen a police car come into the monastery in all the years I was there. So what was that? And it certainly wasn't the normal way of, you know, kind of interaction when a person first comes down to bow to you. Seemed to be some awareness. It seemed to be something else going on. And this particular monk had a very pure, very clear, very powerful mind. And it's almost like we've had that, haven't we? There's some people we meet and we just feel this intuitive friendship and warmth with them. There's other people we meet for the first time and it puts us on edge. It's almost like, hang on, there's something about them we don't trust. The mind almost tunes in. This situation feels uncomfortable. I don't think this person's being honest with me. That's the mind picks up. And when the mind, that mind that picks up things, it picks up what they're projecting, what they're thinking, when that is very refined, when it is very concentrated, when it is very calm, it picks up even more of those messages and become very clearer. And so that's actually one of the other areas of psychic phenomena that arise. The other very important area of psychic phenomena, which is actually very useful for spiritual development, is the ability to recall past lives. The ability to remember where we were, what we're doing before this life. The Buddha had this ability, and many monks have developed their mind to train and develop this ability. There are some lay people I know who have developed this ability. There are many recorded stories, not stories, but actual factual investigations of people, not only Buddhists, but even people who don't believe in past lives, who can recall past lives. There is Professor Stevenson has written many books on this, of people who have, say, been born as Muslims who don't believe in a past life, but as children can recall their past lives, give great details about their life before this one, and they have been followed up, those details, the facts have been proven. There's actually books in the library we have here of many of those areas of research he's done on this. This ability to recall our past lives. Often we ask, well, why can't I recall my past life if I have lived before? And often we see that memory is very weak. Sometimes we can't remember where we put the car keys 5 minutes ago. Yes. Sometimes we can't recall what we were doing at this time, say, 2 weeks ago. What were you doing Saturday 2 weeks ago at 9 o'clock? Can you remember? How many people can remember? One? I can remember I was in my room, I think. Monks, it's fairly easy. We just sort of usually sit in our room. Okay, so out of all the people here, one person has put up their hand. So, you know, how many people can remember what they were doing on Saturday night exactly 10 years ago? I think I was sitting in my room. What about 20 years ago? So we see that it actually, you know, our ability, even though we say, you know, this life is my life, I have experienced this life, but we see that actually that ability, the strength of memory is very, very weak. We actually haven't cultivated that quality. And with this ability to recall past lives, actually one has to train the mind to go back in time to recall what I did yesterday and all the sequences before one got up. And then recall going back, what was your last thought before going to sleep. Then go back in time to remember, back in time before the last birthday, then the year before, and going back, sequencing the recollection until one can go back to one's earliest memory. So if you have a very good sit in your meditation and get very, very peaceful, come out, maybe just play around. What's your earliest memory in this life? See whether just the strength of the recollection improves when the mind is still. And when the mind gets very, very purified, very strong, it can actually take the leap and jump back to the previous life. We had a visiting monk here a while back who was talking about karma and past life events. And he was telling us that one day he was sitting meditation And he was able to recall back 17 lifetimes beforehand. He had actually gone out hunting with a bow and arrow. And he'd seen a chicken, a forest chicken up in the tree. And he'd shot that chicken and the arrow had gone into its leg on the thigh. And the chicken flew down and then flew up a couple of times. And then finally the arrow dropped out and the chicken escaped and got away. After he came out of the meditation, he knew that the karmic consequences of that, because he had seen it in his past life and it had come up, and the karmic consequences were going to fruit. And he said 2 months later, he got a bite on his leg, and the wound was just a little red spot, and it was right in that place that he'd seen in his meditation where the arrow had gone in the chicken's leg. And he said he knew that however long that chicken suffered for with the wound of the arrow, however long it took for that wound to repair, that's how long this wound would last and this sore would last. And he said that he treated this initially with just antiseptic. Then eventually it got infected. And a doctor came and gave him antibiotics and said, you know, just take 7 days, there's no problem, it's very minor. He took the antibiotics, did all the treatment. He'd actually studied medicine as a young man as well, so he knew how to look after these things. He said that it eventually started to get infected, and so much so that his robes, he had to pull, the touch of his robe was just too painful. And then a couple of weeks later, the doctors came and they said that you're going to have an operation. And so it had gone right down to the bone, the infection. And so he went into the operating theater and he asked them not to give anesthetic because he wanted to meditate on whether he could place his mind away from the pain. Eventually that's what they did. They operated without any anesthetic. And when they cut open the wound was right down to the bone, the infection. And he needed, a fistful cotton wool to put into the hole. And then he said that it took 3 months and 26 days eventually for that wound to heal. And he knew that that's how long it took for that animal's injury to recover from how he'd inflicted through that arrow. He saw that that was a recollection of past life. And the ability to recall past lives has, if we could remember, for example, all our lifetimes, yeah? So it's not that we remember that we were, you know, Queen Victoria or we were Napoleon actually, you know, or that, you know, what we really remember is all the things that we're repeating in this lifetime. The Dalai Lama once said that if you want to know what you were like in your last life, look at your body now. If you want to know what you're going to be like in your future life, look at your mind now. That's looking at your mind will indicate where you're going in the future. Who you become and what you lead on to. And this ability to recall our past lives is we realize we've been over the same old ground endless times. How many meals have we consumed? How many days of work and labor have we done? How many relationships have we had? One monk I know, recalling his past lives, remembered he'd been married to the same woman in the same village for 27 past lifetimes. And he said each lifetime she'd died before him and he'd gone to the funeral. And this lifetime, even in this lifetime, when he was a young man, he was 18, and he fell in love with this girl and he wanted to marry her. But his dad asked him to become a monk. And he quite reluctantly became a monk. He didn't want to be. It was just tradition in Thailand at that time. But eventually he discovered the peace of meditation and then obviously gave up any interest in that girl. She got married. And when she died, he went to a funeral. And he came back and told the monks, the reason I went to that funeral was because she has been my wife in 27 lives. And out of gratitude and appreciation. But this is the last time I go to a funeral. There's no more becoming for me. And so, you know, the reason that we meet, the reason we're together, is because of a past cause. So, when your wife or husband or partner starts to argue with you, said, "No, dear, I'm not going to argue. This is going over the same old ground. We've been over and over this many times before." So you don't react. I'm going a little over time, but I will actually talk about the one of the other last and most important psychic abilities, and that is the ability to know the destruction of greed, hatred, and delusion. That is, that arises in the mind, that experience arises in the mind and can be known in the mind. That a person can know the ending of craving, can know the ending of greed, can know the ending of hatred, and know the ending of delusion. Just as you can know when you're angry and upset, and then you develop the opposite, you develop a state of loving kindness, and that anger subsides. You can know its ending. No one has to tell you that. You don't have to believe anybody. You see the experience occur in your own mind. And there is a state where that anger will never arise again. You've cut off the root for anger, cut off the root for greed, cut off the root for delusion. And that is called a psychic power, psychic phenomena. And that one, the Buddha greatly praised. There is another psychic phenomena which I didn't mention. This is very similar to recalling of past lives, and that's to know where other beings go according to their karma. When they die from this life, where they go into the next life. Now that can also be a knowledge and vision. But this important one is the aim of the Buddha's path, the knowing of the cutting off of greed, hatred, and delusion. So in the Buddhist psychology, the Buddha said, yes, this mind is wonderful, it's marvelous. There are many phenomena that can arise in this mind. But he said, what's important? What's important for a particular aim and particular purpose? For his aim, for his purpose of cutting off suffering, the important psychic phenomena is the knowledge of the ending of greed, hate, and delusion. All other psychic experiences are really insignificant unless they enhance that knowledge. They're not really important. So if you hear of someone saying, oh, this person can read your fortune, then you say, it's insignificant. I know if I cut off greed, hatred, and delusion, my fortune will be good. And we see actually how easily, even though we consider ourselves rational and logical and reasonable, we actually get quite shaken by these things. I remember when the Y2K thing came out. You know, the year 2000. And there was sort of, people were supposed to be scientific, rational, logical in the West. But there was an anxiety, wasn't there? What would happen? There was a fear arising. What happened? And I remember one of the Thai people coming up to Ajahn Brahm and saying, oh, well, there's a fortune teller or someone who's prophesized that the year 2000, the world's going to end. And Ajahn Brahm in his normal wit said, okay, if monks are not allowed to bet, okay, but if I could bet, supposing I could bet, I will bet you that if the world ends, he said, if the world doesn't end, OK, Okay, if the world doesn't end at the year 2000, then you have to give all your money, all your wealth to the monastery and come and ordain. Okay? And if the world does end, then I'll give all the wealth, money, and I'll disrobe. And you sort of put it in its rational, sort of logical sort of consequences, and it does seem pretty absurd, doesn't it? And so just to summarize, the aim of psychic phenomena from the Buddhist point of view is the ability to know truth, to see truth, to increase that power of knowledge and understanding so that greed, hatred, and delusion come to an end. That's the goal of psychic phenomena from a Buddhist point of view. And then there is, once you know and see that for themselves, there is another psychic phenomena that the Buddha talked about, and that's the compassion to teach others through that knowledge and understanding of the mind of others and how your mind works and how Dhamma works, how truth works, then to have compassion to teach from that purity others so that they too can come to an end of suffering. So I thank you for your patience. You had a lot of endurance tonight, and I will end here.